Well, Dan, we've got a very special guest, and he is a surviving Vietnam veteran, 101st Airborne Division. Boy, they don't take any prisoners.
No, they don't. Art Wicknick Jr., his book, Namsense, wrote it a few years ago. Art, good morning and welcome to Brad and Dan.
And when did you meet Art?
Well, about 6-7 years ago, right?
Yes, the first time we met was about 5 or 6 years ago, just before I went on the History Channel program. And then and just a few weeks ago, I met Dan again at the Yard Goats game.
Yeah.
He's singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game, and I saw him through the window. I said, I got to go say hi.
I love, you know something? When I got the book, I love the title, Nomsense. How did you come up with
that?
Well,
actually, my first title was Platoon, but then the movie came out. Platoon, so I couldn't use that. And then I worked at Pratt Whitney for many, many years. And we'd sit around at the lunch table and try to come up with titles. And finally, one of the guys says, you know what, it doesn't make any sense that we're even talking about this because your book will never get published. And then the other guy says, yeah, it's nothing but nonsense. And everybody looked at each other. That's it.
That's how you came up with Pratt & Whitney.
Yes.
You came up with it.
Yeah. At lunchtime, I wasn't getting paid.
That's a great story. Oh, my goodness. By the way, if you have any questions for Art, 888-574-2723 is our telephone number. He's in our Touchpoints Rehab interview chair. Why did you write the book?
Well, actually, I always wanted to write anyhow, and I've been somewhat successful writing short stories and getting them published. But right after the movie Hamburger Hill came out, which I was a participant in.
I remember that one.
I went to see the movie, and I thought it was pretty good. But my sister had asked me, what did you think? So I told her what I thought about it, and my niece, who was 15 at the time, she says, well, how would you know about the battle? I said, well, I was there. She says, where? I said, I was in the battle. I was on Hamburger Hill. She says, my God, you were in Vietnam? How did you ever quit your drug habit?
Wow.
And I said, wait a minute. I said, in my mind, if this is what high school kids were being taught or have been led to believe.
Well, it was in the news, no question about
it.
People believe that stuff.
Yeah, of course they do. And because if you hear it enough times, eventually you believe it. And in any war, some people do not act properly. There's good and bad on both sides, but the vast majority of people I knew were brave. They were honorable. They were there to do the job and come home safely. So once I heard that out of her mouth, I was very disappointed. Now, I wasn't mad at her. I was just mad in general that the public had this perception. So I decided to start writing in earnest and talk about my experiences. And the reader will know that, we didn't, at least the guys in my group, we looked down our noses at people who smoked dope.
Yeah, but you were in the 101st Airborne. I mean, this is,
Well, it was. I didn't realize how elite the organization was until, it was big time. They played a pivotal role in World War II. And, to be part of that was very, it was a very proud moment, even though I never even wanted to be in the military. I got drafted and ended up in the 101st when I got to Vietnam. Guy pointed at me, oh, you're an NCO. We need squad leaders in the 101st. That's where you're going.
Wow. So what do you remember about being drafted? Take us back to that time.
Well, I was 19 years old, and like I said, I had just gotten a job at Pratt & Whitney. And, I was making good money. I was living at home. My parents didn't charge me any rent. You couldn't beat that. I bought a brand new 1968 Camaro. I had a girlfriend that I was crazy about. I was living the life of the American teenager. It was great. And then I got my draft notice, which was devastating. But at that time, in 1968, guys were being drafted. So it wasn't like, why was I being singled out? I wasn't being singled out. It's just the way it was. And the war was gaining more notoriety. We were losing a lot of guys, so they had to keep filling those ranks, and they did it through the draft. So when I first started basic training at Fort Dix, New Jersey, one of the things you do is fill out a document called a dream sheet. And what it is that the Army's looking for, what kind of background do you have? What kind of jobs or what kind of talents do you have that the Army might be able to use? Well, I worked first at a chicken farm, and then I got the job at Pratt. So, and I had only been there for a few months, so I had really no talent to offer. But I went to church a lot, so I put down that I wanted to be a chaplain's assistant, because I figured that's a good, safe job. So I go before an interviewer, and he looks at the paper, and he says, oh, chaplain's assistant. He says, do you have any seminary training? I said, no. And he says, well, are you going to take seminary training after the military? I said, no. my parents always taught me, never lie. So number two, he looks at the next thing I put down pastry chef. He says, oh, all right, do you have any culinary training? No. Now the guy's looking at me kind of strange, and he says, are you going to take any culinary training? And I says, no. He says, well, guess what? You're going in the infantry.
101st Airborne. All right.
Oh, wow. Well.
So anyhow, that was my introduction to the Army, you know, and, you know, basic training was difficult, but, you know, we lived kind of in a rural area of Connecticut, and my brother and I were always out in the woods running around, and, so it was almost fun to go through the, to do the physical training when there was a lot of kids there from the New York, New Jersey area who were city kids, and some of them were a little plump and had a little problem, you know, doing the doing all the physical training. But after 8 weeks, these guys slimmed down because the Army really pushes you and, you know, makes you a better person physically.
What did you feel like? And I've been dying to meet you to ask you this question. I remember meeting. I was in San Francisco at the time. I remember meeting some fellas that just got out, okay? And they were in the men's room taking their uniforms off and putting on what civilian clothes they had, whether it be shorts, whether it be this, because they didn't want to go out to meet the public and let the public know that they had been in the armed forces. That's how bad it was. Did that happen to you?
Well, actually, what happened to me is, I'm if you want to call it mustered out, I got out at Fort Lewis, Washington, and we were told to it might be a good idea to take a late flight to get into wherever you're going, try to get there late at night. So people don't see you. And I'm thinking, what do you mean, so people don't see me? I just survived a year in Vietnam. I was in the jungle for a year. I'm going to wear my uniform. I'm proud of my uniform. So I landed at Bradley, and I'm walking through the terminal. And, you know, I've got a chest full of ribbons. I'm carrying my duffel bag. I feel like $1 million. And I noticed that there wasn't anyone else in the airport that had a uniform on. I was the only one. I didn't think too much of it at first, but then I see people poking each other and pointing at me, and not like, hey, look, a soldier. It's, look, a soldier. You can tell just by the looks on their faces that I was not welcomed. So what I did is I called my cousin, come and get me. My parents weren't home. I was trying to surprise them by coming home early. So I called my cousin. He came in while I was waiting. I went to a waiting area, and a lot of people were filtering in that area. And as I sat there, people came in and took one look at me and kind of jerked their head back and then went over and sat in a corner. No one would sit on the left of me or the right of me. People either stood against the wall or sat on the floor when the seats were full, then take a seat next to me. It was the most disappointing, heartbreaking moment of my homecoming. 5 minutes before that, I was on top of the world. But at that moment, feeling so unwelcome, I just had to get home. I had to get out of that uniform because everything I heard was true, that we were looked upon as a pariah. I didn't know what to do. So something I had been so proud of now was something to be ashamed of.
Why did you think, Art, that people felt that way, that they intercepted their or commingled these thoughts about those who served in the military and the government? You were just doing your job for the government.
Exactly. It's very unfortunate. And in my book, I even talk about the My Lai massacre, which occurred even before I went in the Army. When I was on R&R in Hawaii, I met a girl on the beach, and the first thing out of her mouth was, oh, how many women or children did you kill at My Lai? How do you even respond to this?
You said what? Yeah. What was it? What did she say to you?
She asked me how many women and children I killed at during the My Lai massacre.
Wow.
Again, how do you respond to that? I had nothing to do with that. I wasn't even in the Army then. That happened in, I think, March of 68.
That's right.
And I didn't go in until April of 68. Mm-hmm. So the country had a terrible taste in their mouth for Vietnam veterans at that time. Today, things are totally different, which I'm so glad.
I was going to ask you about that. It has changed?
Oh, it's changed dramatically. Now, when we came home, we could not wear our uniforms, and that was very, very disappointing. So, but
I was shocked when I saw that in San Francisco.
It was terrible. So, again, you know, you're so proud of what you've accomplished and so proud that you survived. And the country, in general, did not care. So today, when I see men and women in uniform walking around, that's my homecoming. I get homecomings every day now.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm not bitter about what happened in the past because that's the way things were at the time. Today it's different, and I think the men and women who serve today deserve a heck of a lot more credit than I ever got or that I even want. Because, number one, they're volunteers, something I would have never done because I got drafted. I didn't want to go. And they do 2, 3, 4 deployments. And you know, the general public does not understand the sacrifices that the families have to go through when someone goes off to war or when they're deployed. Even if they're not in a war zone, they could be stationed stateside. They're away from their family. They're missing holidays. They're missing events at home. So being in the military is a very tough job, and I give today's young people a lot of credit for that.
Art Winnick, Jr., author of the book Nonsense. I love the title. A Vietnam vet served with the 101st Airborne Division.
Art, are we talking much about the Vietnam War today in our schools or in classes?
I don't know for sure because I haven't I don't visit too many schools right now, but Connecticut State University has a Veterans History program, and I'm invited every year to go to speak at Rocky Hill High School. So a lot of the kids there, it's not just Vietnam vets, it's Afghan, Iraq vets, and even some World War II vets are there. And so I'm just glad that schools like that have a veterans program where they invite us in and have the kids ask questions. And they can ask any question they want because I've got nothing to hide.
What do they usually ask?
Well, one kid always asks, did you ever kill anybody? And that is the question. I don't even like answering that one. But I don't know. I guess to a 12 or 13-year-old, there's some excitement in going off to war. And there is no excitement in going off to war. No one hates war more than someone who experienced it firsthand, believe me. But I think it's great that the kids at least have are inquisitive. And anytime someone wants to invite me to a school, I'm more than happy to go.
You got to get a hold of this book, Nonsense. I mean, when you talk about the history of war, when you talk about Vietnam, when you talk about the 101st Airborne Division, I mean, it's an incredible story.
Art, there are light moments in the book too, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's kind of dark humor because when you're in a combat situation, you know, you're not telling jokes without any expletives or anything. But we also had some, I would say, maybe not totally incompetent. We had some second lieutenants that came our way that, you know, these guys are called butter bars, and there's a reason for that. Because
butter bars. Oh, yes.
Why?
Their lieutenant bar was gold, and first lieutenant's bar was silver.
Silver. Yep.
But, so the gold bar, as it got a little tarnished, it looked like butter. So we call them butter bars. And everybody knows that they're new guys. You know, they're new lieutenants. So they're flexing their muscles. They're trying to prove that, you know, I'm a commissioned officer for a reason. And, but, you know, you have men under you who have a lot of experience. So, you know, you might want to listen to them a little bit before you start making some decisions. So we had a second lieutenant. I talk about him in the book, and of course I did not use his real name because I don't want to be sued, but, he was, he was an idiot.
I mean, we never had those in the Marine Corps.
Yeah, you guys are all squared away. Yeah. Right? No, I mean, but you find these people in business. You find people right. who you know think they've got it all together, and they're really they're idiots. Yeah, they're idiots. So we'd run into this into these guys occasionally, and I've had some very good commanders. I had some outstanding superiors that. Yeah, once the guy gave an order, boom, you go and do it because this guy knows what he's doing. But we had this one lieutenant who I call Kramer in the book. He was just a dope, and he'd say, "Hey, we're gonna kill the enemy. We're gonna earn a bunch of medals." And everybody's looking at each other like, "No, we just want to go home. You know, if we run into these guys, yeah, we'll engage them, but let's not go looking for trouble." You know, but he wanted to, you know, make a name for himself because officers in Vietnam, they did 6 months field duty and then 6 months in the rear, where we do 12 months field duty. So, you know, they have a very short window to earn whatever medals they hope to achieve. Where we, you know, we're a bunch of draftees or guys who joined and wonder why we ever did that. And, you know, we just want to survive and go back home to our girlfriends, to our wives and the life we used to know. While the officers typically want to make a career out of the military.
Right. Now, what was the landscape like with the jungles and the hills and all?
Well, there were several different landscapes. When I first arrived there, we were in what was known as I Corps, which is the northernmost province of Vietnam. And that was north of the city of Hue, where we had the Tet Offensive took place. That's where the bulk of the Tet Offensive took place. And Quang Tri was the next large city north of us. So we're in between those two locations. And along the coastline, it was sand dunes and, pockets of shrubs and things like that. But as you go inland, it gets a little thicker. But the hills were rolling hills, if you can imagine Kansas or someplace like that. Not a lot of trees, but there was bamboo thickets. And during the daytime, we'd hide in those bamboo thickets and hope to maybe spot an enemy soldier wandering around. And at night, we'd leave the safety of those thickets, and we'd ambush any trails that led off into the jungle, which was not far away. As you get past those rolling hills, then the mountains began, and those are heavily forested or triple canopy jungle. Very thick, hot, humid, snakes everywhere, mosquitoes the size of turkeys, or seemed like it.
What did you do to protect yourself?
Well, from which one?
from the snakes and the mosquitoes.
Well,
did you do much?
We always kept our eye out for snakes because over there they had what they called a two-stepper. It was a bamboo viper. If you get bit by one of those, you can maybe make two steps before you drop dead. So any snake that we saw met a very violent death. Any snake. We'd either shoot them, chop their heads off with a machete. You know, snakes you were always looking around, always, because some of these snakes you can't see.
Wow. Imagine that. I mean, not only do you have to look at the enemy, enemy sometimes is within the snakes.
You're looking for tripwire, especially if you're walking trails. And sometimes the terrain dictated you can only walk a trail. Otherwise, you know, if the hillsides are too steep, you can't really walk on those. So you have to walk a trail, and you always got your eyes out for tripwires or areas that may conceal a bomb of some sort.
Hold those thoughts. Art's going to be back after the news.
Right after the news. Nam Sense. That's the title of the book. The book is called Nam Sense. Arthur Witnick Jr. is the author, a surviving Vietnam veteran from the 101st Airborne Division. Dan, what a delight to have Art with us. And he was just telling me before the news, I said, he was talking about New Haven. He was down there, and he bumped into, I guess, a Marine Corps drill instructor, and I'll let him tell you the rest.
Well, on the day that we took the oath of allegiance, once you take the oath, the military or the U.S. government owns you. So there was probably 50 or 60 of us at the induction station, and we just finished taking the oath, and whoever was officiating, I think it was an Army captain or somebody, he says, oh, by the way, we have Sergeant so-and-so from the Marine Corps. He wants to talk to you. So this guy comes up to the podium, and, I mean, this guy really looks sharp. You know, he looked like the typical Marine, you know, chest out, ribbons on his chest, and he says, I need four volunteers for the Marines. Who is interested? And everybody's looking around like, well, not me. So he says, well, anybody want to go in on the buddy system? So then two guys, they kind of looked at each other, said, yeah, as long as we can train together, we'll go. So I said, okay, that's two guys. Go through that door over there, and my assistant will take your name and all your information. So he says, okay, anybody else? And one guy's kind of looking. He raises his hand real slow. And he's, aha, okay, you, one more. Yes, that's good. All right, so he goes in there. You know, he sends him on his way and go sees the assistant. And he says, all right, I need one more. One more, come on. Who's it going to be? And everybody, I'm looking out the window. So he says, all right, if I don't get a volunteer, I'm going to pick someone. So the guy, the knucklehead behind me, says, no effing way. And the Marine looked right at me and pointed at me and says, you are a Marine. And I'm standing, I'm shaking, and I start to walk away, and he says, no, not you, you moron. The guy behind you, the one with the mouth. He's a Marine.
I can hear it now.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's a great story.
Oh, yeah. Not if you were there.
No. All right. How can people pick up a copy of the book?
Well, it's on Amazon and under Nomsense, NAMSENSE. But I also have a website, nomsense.com. And if you want a signed copy, you can send me an email. You can order it through me. Of course, this postage.
You've sold a lot of these.
I've sold over 20,000 copies.
Yeah, that's
20,000 copies. Can you imagine?
So it's done very well. And of course, being on the History Channel helped. I was also on the Military Channel, which is now American Heroes Channel.
That's where you saw him on the History
Channel. Well, on the History Channel, we had him on because you were part of that documentary. Is that documentary still around? Can you access it?
Believe it or not, they play that two or three times a year.
Really?
For Memorial Day or just before Memorial Day, just before Veterans Day. So if people ever see Vietnam in HD on the History Channel, you'll see me there.
Yeah, you're in there.
So it was a real honor to be selected for that. They did a nationwide search for 13 individuals who had ties to the Vietnam War, either veterans or civilians. There was two civilians. One was a woman whose husband was a POW, and the other is Joe, the war correspondent, Joe Galloway?
Galloway.
Yeah. Joe Galloway. Yeah, yeah. He was there, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, and I had to do three telephone interviews before they even picked me. So, you know, that tells me they went through a lot of people, but they wanted someone who could show emotion. And at this stage of my life, I don't know why, but I break down sometimes. Yeah. And when I talk about these things. So they said, you're the guy we want. You can cry. We want you.
Wow. Well, and I remember watching it at the time, and I'm sure you could also pick up a copy of, I'm sure it's in DVD form if you go on the History Channel website.
Right.
But it is, they did a great job, I thought.
I thought it was terrific, and one of the things that they did is, once I did my interview, and all this took place in Pennsylvania, they invited my wife and I down to view some of the footage. And they had a couple of Vietnam vets in there doing sound. And to get the sound of walking through brush, they had these guys recording walking through a cornfield.
Wow.
And so there's a lot of little secrets that I thought was pretty neat.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they had Vietnam vets do a lot of the editing is because they wanted to make sure they had the right uniforms, the right equipment that they had. They wanted to make it as accurate as possible. And I thought they did a phenomenal job.
No, they got the right input then.
Yes.
Yeah. Brad, I know we're coming up on a traffic update, so we'll get that.
And we're going to check that out. It's coming up to 16 minutes after the hour of 8 o'clock. We'll get back to our very, very special guest, Arthur Wicknick Jr., Nomsense, the title of a best-selling book, over 20,000 copies. Would you believe that? Arthur Wicknick Jr., Nonsense. You know, I'm sitting right next to him. Dan is right next to us, too. And I noticed I have not seen a Mickey Mouse watch. And I mean, I love watches. I do. I love watches. I haven't seen a Mickey Mouse watch since I was, I don't know how old. Well, where did you get the, and you're wearing it now. Where did you get the watch?
Well, actually, you can pick these up at the Disney store, but.
You picked up at the Disney store?
Yes.
I got to get one again.
Okay. But anyhow, the reason I wear a Mickey Mouse watch is when I was in Vietnam, I was about my fifth or sixth month, and my girlfriend's letters suddenly stopped. So as she was writing, I was getting like three or four letters a week, which was great. You know, it keeps you sustained. And then when they stopped, maybe for almost a month, and I, you know, the mail was okay because I was getting letters from my parents and my sister, but you know, her letters stopped. So I was very depressed because I knew something had happened. She's home having fun and I'm not. So. Anyhow, it was one of those nights. It was a rainy night. It was miserable. And believe it or not, as hot as it gets over there, when you're wet, you get cold. And I'm just sitting there. I'm almost ready to give up on even sustaining myself. I didn't care anymore because I figured I lost her. And so a guy comes over to me and says, "Hey, Sergeant Wicknick, it's your turn for guard. Here, take my watch so you can, so you know when your hour is up." And we always used luminous watches at night because they glow in the dark. So you can see when your time is up and you wake up the next guy. So he hands me this watch, and what it is, it's a pocket watch, a Mickey Mouse pocket watch, the size of a silver dollar. So I'm looking at that watch, and I said, "Wow, Mickey Mouse out here, you know, out in the jungle." So I'm looking at this watch, and I'm thinking, my God, how nice would it be to be home again, to have my father yelling at me instead of me being here. And, you know, and I thought about, you know, we used to play softball with the neighborhood kids, and we'd go ice skating at the local pond. And, every afternoon, after school, my sisters and I would come home and we'd watch the Mickey Mouse Club. And there's something about thinking about home and that watch that made me feel like, man, I can survive this. You know, I don't give a rat about my girlfriend now. I got to get home. I got 6 months to go. So that watch, for whatever reason, gave me the courage or the desire to keep going. So when I came home, one of the first things I did is I bought a Mickey Mouse watch, and I've worn one ever since because when I look at it, I'm always reminded of that night when I was ready to just give up. I didn't care if the enemy killed me or not, but Now I think about, you know what, you know, life is, life throws a lot of curves at you. And if you can survive, if I can survive Vietnam, I can survive anything. And I keep the watch on as a reminder that life is not so bad. It's not so tough. It's what you make it.
Wow. What
an inspiration.
That's a great story.
I asked the question.
Yes, we've got a call.
Okay, let's go to Chuck in Naugatuck. Chuck, good morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. What an interesting show. Nick, I'm sorry, Art.
Yes.
In Waterbury, we have a great veterans committee and a lot of Vietnam veterans. If you're ever interested, Mr. Bob Dorr, he's like the historian, or Doc Docio. They've helped so many veterans and living in and ones that have passed. But thank you for your service. My cousin just passed from ALS. He was a lieutenant colonel, a combat rescue pilot in Vietnam, the 1st Division. He just passed, 78 years old, and I didn't know all the medals and all the, you know, hero things that he had done there. I mean, we just found out he passed away a couple of months ago, and we just got his obituary. He was out in Virginia when he retired. But so many servicemen, that friends of mine that came back, one friend of mine, Jungle Rot. I mean, every hot summer, his back, all the whatever disease that is that comes out. Another good friend of mine, very good friend of mine, 8 years ago died from Agent Orange at 62 years old. And it was so heartbreaking. I mean, he was fine and healthy all his life. He was a supervisor for Connecticut Light and Power, a linesman. It was just heartbreaking. But what they didn't tell you in Vietnam, like in his instance, in his case, he was a heavy artillery operator, and he was out in the jungle, and he used to spray the foliage with that Agent Orange. And they never ever told our servicemen the dangers of, you know, they had no shirts on, their pores were open, they were breathing that stuff in. I mean, it was really heartbreaking on the side of what our government didn't tell our soldiers.
It is disappointing that all these events occur, and at the time, I don't know if we were just ignorant or maybe the military didn't want to put that information out. I don't have a good answer for you. I do want to mention that. Now, you're calling in from Naugatuck?
Yes.
All right. The girlfriend I was just talking about, she was from Naugatuck. So I'm not going to mention her name. But
Chuck probably knows her.
Yeah. Well, actually, I'm from Waterchuck. I'm right on the boundary line, and these guys that I call in, they know me pretty good, but I probably do know her. You're right. I know the family, I'm sure, probably. But
anyhow, you mentioned jungle rot, and that is something that we experience quite a bit. And one of the things, especially out in the bush, we did not wear any underclothes because we had you sweat so much, your body has to breathe.
Right.
So, and every once in a while, we get a new guy out there who had a pair of boxer shorts on, and he'd come down with a case of jungle rot in his crotch.
Wow.
And man, oh man, that poor guy, he would suffer. And the first thing we tell him, get rid of those underwear.
Yeah.
Because you're not breathing.
But it reoccurs after all these years.
I'm not sure about that. But and I'm lucky I never had it.
One friend of mine, we were at the beach after he got out, and it was a hot day, and we were out in Milford, and
his back was
all broken out. And stuff.
Yeah,
that's a jungle. That's one of my remembrances of Vietnam, even.
Yeah, they're sores that they're pussy sores that reoccur, and it's very itchy, it's very irritating, and you look like you got the.
There's no treatment for it?
I really don't know because
right.
I never,
never had it.
So I didn't have to worry about it. But it looks like, the worst case of acne in the history of the world.
Yeah. Wow.
Chuck, thanks for the call.
Thank
you very, very much.
Take care.
Great job there, Art.
Thank you.
God bless
thanks.
You.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. You do a lot of writing, don't you?
Yes. Yep.
And your books have been, your stories have been included in the Chicken Soup series.
Yes.
Talk a bit about that.
Chicken Soup, they had a request for veteran stories about 7 or 8 years ago. So I wrote one about my homecoming. And ever since then, I've been put on their mailing list, and they keep sending me ideas. And Chicken Soup is very hard to get into because they get up to 5,000 stories per book title, and they whittle it down to 101.
Wow.
So I've been in 8 Chicken Soup stories.
Oh, that's congratulations.
Eight of them.
Quite an honor.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, and I just submitted another one about a month ago about my nutty cousin because they had a request for My Crazy Relatives is the title of the book title. So he had a...
What's the title?
My Crazy Relatives.
My Crazy... You got great titles. Yes.
My cousin had an obsession with mannequins. So
did you take any courses for writing? Or
actually, at Pratt & Whitney, I did take a I took an effective speaking course and also writing. It was called Simplified English, and because we had my job required us to have contact with a lot of foreign companies, who bought our engines. So Plus, I always liked to write. I used to write a lot of love letters, too, to girls. And after I got married, my wife told me, it's time to stop the love letters.
Unless they're to me, right?
Yeah, that's right.
But, what's interesting is, and this, when it comes to writing, if you love to write, that's the best education for improving your writing skills. Like anything else, you just got to keep at it.
Absolutely.
Day in, day out.
Absolutely. In fact, several years ago when Lowell Weicker was running or trying to push the income tax, I was relentless. I was writing letters to the editor like every day to the Current, to a Middletown paper. And then, believe it or not, I got a letter from Lowell Weicker asked me to knock it off.
Really?
Because that was brutal.
And, that was Lowell Weicker.
And right after that, and I didn't stop, but right after that, I was banned from these two newspapers. So, Lowell Well, it probably had nothing to do with that.
No, but, sure. Wow.
Well,
again, one more time, Art, how people can get a copy of your book, Namsense.
Well, if they want a signed copy, they can go to my website, namsense.com, N-A-M-S-E-N-S-E. And, but it's also on Amazon. They have an, it's an e-book, or they can get a soft cover. This is high quality soft cover. And, there are no hardcovers left. Unfortunately, they sold out. But so the book's selling well. And like I said, it's got me on the History Channel. It got me on the Military Channel.
Are you amazed it's done this well after all these years of spending print?
Yes. Yes. I you know, it sells, almost 1,000 books a year.
Wow.
It's terrific. So yeah. It's a timeless story.
Yeah, it really is.
Well, yeah. I tell you, it's just great, having you here. Well,
thank you.
Fabulous. I'm glad you met some Marines, though.
And you just met another one.
Yes.
God bless you.
Well, thank you so
Arch.
Much.
Wow.
Semper Fi.